This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 24th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, Republicans make a final attempt to alter the health care package before it becomes law. More settlements in East Jerusalem are announced as Israel's prime minister wraps up a tense U.S. visit. And we'll go to India, where health workers are drawing attention to the connection between tobacco and tuberculosis in the fight against the disease. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. and Russian negotiators have reached a tentative deal on the renewal of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, according to several media sources. The new START treaty would reduce the nuclear arsenal of both countries by about 25%. At the White House press briefing today, Robert Gibbs said the agreement is very close.
But won't have one until President Obama and his counterpart, Mr. Medvedev, have a chance to speak again.
Gibbs said that meeting would likely take place within the next few days and that he believes both sides have negotiated in good faith. Stalled negotiations failed to produce an agreement before the previous treaty expired in December. There is tentative talk of a signing ceremony in Prague in early April. Representatives from the National Black Farmers Association were at the Capitol today, calling for Congress to act on a settlement agreement reached in February. Black farmers won a settlement from the U.S. government for being excluded from USDA assistance programs because of racism. But even though the money has been promised, nothing can happen until Congress allocates the funds. The farmers are worried that Congress won't act before the next break, which begins April 1st. John Boyd Jr., the head of the National Black Farmers Association, says he is worried that another planting season will pass before the issue is finally resolved. The U.S. and Mexican governments have announced a strategy shift in the drug war on the heels of a high-level binational meeting. FSRN's Shannon Young has more from Mexico.
Headlines from the summit emphasize the announcement of a more social approach to the issues at the root of Mexico's drug violence. That may sound like good news to a public that has grown weary of the military strategy that has claimed 18,000 Mexican lives in the past 3 years. But the announcement was short on specifics on just how this new social strategy will be carried out. Also, without concrete details, was the U.S. promise to try to curb demand at home, the world's most lucrative drug market. Other new binational initiatives will include the sharing of information on convicted criminals deported to Mexico, tougher penalties for people traveling with forged documents, and a joint security program for the violent border metropolis of Ciudad Juarez. Both countries also agreed to tackle the flow of arms and laundered money from the U.S. into Mexico. Financing for the plan comes from the $1.4 billion Mérida Initiative, a military spending program similar to Plan Colombia. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
The U.S. Postal Service is moving towards a 5-day delivery plan, hoping to cut out Saturday's mail service in order to cut back on costs. The Postal Service has been experiencing severe budget shortages and revenue losses over the past decade. Today, the Post Office Board voted to take the first step in the process, which is to ask the Postal Regulatory Commission for an opinion on the proposal. Congress would have to approve the final change. This is part of a larger cost savings plan that includes restructuring retiree health plans and postage rate increases. The UN Refugee Agency says in 2009, Afghanistan overtook Iraq to be the country with the highest number of asylum seekers. Nearly 27,000 Afghans sought asylum status. Iraq still had the second most with 24,000 people, and nearly 23,000 people from Somalia sought asylum last year. Uruguay's former dictator, Juan Bordaberry, has received a 30-year jail sentence for crimes committed during his 3-year dictatorship in the early 1970s. FSRN's Manuela Adalbe attended yesterday's sentencing in Montevideo and files this story.
Juan Bordaberry dissolved the government in 1973, beginning 12 years of military dictatorship in Uruguay. A judge ruled that during Bordaberry's time in office, he violated the constitution, disappeared 9 people, and assassinated 4 others. Bordaberry, who is now 81 years old, has been under house arrest because of poor health. He traveled to the Justice Palace in an ambulance using wheelchair and oxygen tank. Despite his sentence, Bordaberry may not serve any time in jail. Last week, in an attempt to ease prison overcrowding, President José Mujica declared that people older than 70 should be held under house arrest. This decision has caused controversy in the government and among the families of victims because most of the guilty government officials are currently over that age. Manuel Aldave, Free Speech Radio News, Montevideo.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. In Washington, the Senate is debating the revisions package to the health care bill that President Obama signed into law yesterday. Republicans are attempting to derail the package by offering highly politicized measures. Meanwhile, Democrats are coming together to complete health care, even if it means letting go of the public option. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Republicans are offering a flurry of amendments to the health care bill. They range from relevant to health care to politically motivated. One by Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma would outlaw the pregnancy-preventing morning-after pill. It's attached to a measure that would be difficult for any politician to reject, prohibiting convicted pedophiles from purchasing Viagra. The move, though, is tactical. Republicans could use it in a campaign ad that accuses Democrats of supporting Viagra for sex offenders. Democrats are dismissing these political traps.
A vote for any amendment is a vote against health reform.
That's Democratic Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa. He hopes Democrats are unified, because if not, it could derail the revisions to the health care bill.
If any amendment passes, the bill has to go back to the House. That gives opponents of reform more opportunities to make mischief and actually kill the bill.
It is not only Republican amendments Democrats are denouncing, but their own parties as well, including the public option, which is a government-run insurance alternative to compete next to private insurance programs. Democratic Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey supports the public option, but he says it needs to be shelved for the time being.
Because at the end of the day, we will neither get public option nor the ultimate bill that we're seeking, which is the health care reform that will add so much. So there'll be other opportunities, but to do it now is just to kill the very avenue that will give you the health reform we want.
Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado wrote a letter to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid a few weeks ago, asking that the public option be a part of this so-called fixes bill. Senator Bennett has received the support of 24 fellow signatories and the verbal support of a dozen more Senate Democrats. But last week, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid wrote public option supporters and promised them a vote on the public option in the coming months. It appears that Democrats have acquiesced and agree with the strategy. Again, Senator Harkin.
I believe it will come to pass. Not on this bill, and if a public option is offered as an amendment today, I will vote against it, even though I'm for it, because the greater good is getting the bill passed.
Public interest groups and unions who are vocally opposed to health care reform without a public option are singing the same tune as the Democrats. Chuck Loveless is with the American Federation of State, County, and Local Employees.
This is not the time to reopen previous battles. We fought for many things, including the public insurance option, and we still support it. But to pass health care reform, we've all had to compromise.
Voting on amendments will begin this evening. Under Senate rules, an unlimited number of amendments to alter the bill can be offered. How many Republicans offer could depend on how much stamina they have to vote continuously through the night. Democrats hope no changes are made so the revisions can go straight to the president's desk. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The House of Representatives passed another jobs bill today. It aims to provide tax relief for small businesses and create bonds to help local governments fund infrastructure projects. It is one in a string of jobs bills passed by Congress to bring down historically high unemployment rates, including the HIRE Act, which was signed into law by the president last week. But despite these bills, black leaders say Congress and the president need to do more to stimulate job growth in minority communities. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
While lawmakers were inside the Capitol working to pass a new jobs bill, black leaders gathered as the National Urban League released its annual State of Black America report. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton were on hand as Urban League President Mark Morial urged Congress to do more on jobs.
Congress has passed a number of jobs bills. Those jobs bills are excellent steps in the right direction. But this team doesn't need a bunt. This team needs a home run. Yes. This team doesn't need a field goal. This team needs a touchdown.
The Urban League's report states that one marker of equality, civic engagement, rose because of increased voter turnout among blacks during the 2008 presidential election season. But standards of social justice, economics, health, and education are still much lower for blacks than for whites, says the report. Unemployment among blacks is nearly twice as high as for whites. Morial says that's why Congress must do more to target the poorest areas of the country, many of which are black.
So I've said to people, the way policy should be constructed is to place an emphasis on those that are chronically unemployed, whether they're white, black, Hispanic, or Asian. That emphasis should be placed on communities where the unemployment rate is high, where the poverty rate is high. That sort of targeting will impact our community.
Meanwhile, the jobs bill that passed in the House on Wednesday aims to help small businesses by decreasing capital gains taxes and increasing deductions for startup costs. The $14 billion bill also extends the Build America Bonds program, which began under the stimulus in order to help local and state government attract private funding for local projects. Some say Democrats are anxious to demonstrate their commitment to job creation leading up to the midterm elections this fall. But Republican Congressmember Roscoe Bartlett of Maryland says the bill won't create jobs.
But the tax increases in this bill are greater than the cuts to small business. Yeah, and it's a hodgepodge of cuts. It's not really focused. But to the extent that they're reducing the tax on small business, I applaud them. But the overall tax effect of this bill is an increase in taxes, not a decrease in taxes.
However, the bill passed Wednesday with mostly Democratic votes. Sheila Jackson Lee supported the bill, but she echoed concerns from the Urban League and black leaders that Congress must do more to target aid to minority communities.
The real problem is in the translation of this money that we send to our districts and to the state. They don't seem to care about reaching out to the African American community, minority communities, and getting them engaged in jobs, getting them engaged in training. And I think at a certain point, we have to say enough is enough. You're using federal dollars, you're benefiting from it, then you need to grow the workforce in the community.
The Urban League has offered their own jobs proposal to Obama's cabinet and to Congress that targets communities with the highest unemployment rates and expands programs for summer youth employment, job training, and green jobs. Last month, Morial joined other black leaders to meet with the president. Morial says he came away from that meeting confident that the president will do more to target jobs for minorities.
Because we want to send the most powerful message, the strongest message possible, that a nation which can invest trillions of dollars bailing out banks and financial institutions can and should and must pass a jobs bill that matters in America's communities.
Democrats say the current jobs bill should be signed into law in time for some of its provisions to take effect over the summer. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
This week, a federal court lifted a ban that prohibits companies from owning multiple media platforms, such as a television station and a newspaper, within the same market. The Federal Court of Appeals for the 3rd District issued the temporary removal of the ban in a decision on Tuesday. The case dates back to former FCC Chair Michael Powell and his efforts to remove the ban on cross-ownership in large media markets. Media watchdog groups have said that removing the ban could lead to further consolidation in a media system increasingly controlled by large companies. Supporters say it's a necessary step to encourage competition. Jonathan Lawson is executive director for Reclaim the Media, a grassroots media justice organization based in Seattle. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks.
Now, supporters of this ban say it only applies to the top 20 media markets. Could it still affect local community news, and if so, how?
Well, sure. First of all, the top 20 media markets sounds like a small number, but that's really affecting directly like 45% of the people in the United States. So the largest 20 media markets represents a huge influence on media in the country. Also, a lot of the major media markets are also regional media providers. So a regional newspaper in Chicago or Seattle or Houston is going to provide very important service to a whole area of the country. So it'll definitely have an effect on local media markets.
So I want to talk a little bit about how that effect will play out. The Project for Excellence in Journalism released a study. It was a five-year study in 2003 that did find that local television news owned by local companies generally provided better news, and they warned that further consolidation could erode the quality of media. But in what ways does consolidation affect the content of media?
Well, the push for consolidation since the mid-90s has come from the big media companies that are not owned by media families the way that traditional newspapers were 100 years ago. Some still are. They're owned by large conglomerates who are looking to benefit their bottom lines, and they're looking to consolidate in order to cut costs by taking two newsrooms and combining them into one, by taking 20 radio newsrooms and combining them into one or reducing them to zero. Cutting costs for a media institution means cutting the amount of journalism. It means not investing in long-form investigative reporting. It means not investing in local reporting and not investing in journalistic experiments. Consolidation has really played a huge role in driving down the quality as well as the quantity of journalism, and this recent decision by the court will allow the consolidation to continue in that same bad direction.
We did reach out to the FCC. They declined to be interviewed on air, but referred us to a statement from FCC Commissioner Robert McDowell. He applauded the ruling. He said that the ban is part of, quote, burdensome ownership rules that are many years out of date. He also mentioned that current media climate that you describe as a reason for lifting the ban, that newspapers, media organizations are really hurting in this economic climate, and they would be helped by this. Your response?
The last time the FCC did a consideration of these ownership rules, it was hugely controversial. The FCC heard from thousands of people across the country saying, do not allow more consolidation, we don't want it. And the previous chairman, Kevin Martin, really rammed through this loosening of the media ownership rules. It was a very poor process without considering or even listening to all the public input. It was a very controversial and very bad ruling, immediately controversial, and it was stayed by the courts, in fact. When the courts were considering whether or not to lift that stay, the FCC ruled in very strongly in favor of keeping the ruling stayed so that they could have a better public process with the current Obama administration FCC. I think the current chairman is being a little politic when he's sort of applauding the ruling and saying, well, let us continue doing our work. But it's clearly controversial, and I think it's clearly going against what most people instinctively want from media regulation.
And the FCC is set to do a review of media ownership rules that happens every 4 years. This issue will likely be an important part of that. What's likely to come next?
It will be again, and it's true that with the changed media landscape, the increasing prominence of the Internet, the issue of media ownership consolidation is clearly one among many different considerations for getting better media, and getting better media is really the point. So the FCC is going to take up consideration of media consolidation rules again, but they're also doing a lot of work on stimulating broadband diversity, which can offer people who have been shut out of broadcast media new ways to get into it if the proceeding is done right and we have an open internet and net neutrality.
Jonathan Lawson is Executive Director for Reclaim the Media, a media justice organization based in Seattle that's also part of the Magnet Media Action Grassroots Network. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
White House officials are mostly staying silent after President Obama met privately with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday evening. The two leaders meet at a tense moment in U.S.-Israel relations, following a second announcement of more settlement construction in East Jerusalem. The Israeli Jerusalem municipality approved the construction of 20 more units for Jewish settlers in an area near the Shepherd Hotel in occupied East Jerusalem. From Bethlehem, FSRN's Ghassan Bonora reports.
The Shepherd Hotel is located in Sheikh Jarrah Palestinian neighborhood, the scene of repeated takeovers of Palestinian homes by Jewish settlers. The hotel was purchased for $1 million by Jewish-American billionaire Erwin Moscovich in 1985. He plans to demolish it in order to build homes for Jewish settlers in the Arab neighborhood. The planning committee of the Jerusalem municipality issued an initial approval of the plan in July of 2009, which at the time drew condemnation from the United States. On Wednesday, Israeli officials confirmed the construction could now begin. The plan includes the construction of 20 units, enough space for 100 families. The Shepherd Hotel, one of the historic sites in Jerusalem, will remain as it is according to the current plan. Fawziya Al-Kurd is a resident whose house was taken over by Israeli settlers in 2008. She commented on Israel's new construction in Sheikh Jarrah.
First of all, it is a provocative decision. I personally refuse to accept it at all. I demand to go back to my house where my life and memories are. Additionally, I'm a refugee since 1948, so I demand my right to return. And then I demand to go back to my house in Sheikh Jarrah.
U.S.-Israeli relations have been tense since Israel's announcement earlier this month that it is planning to build 50,000 settlers' homes in East Jerusalem. The Obama administration considers Israeli settlement construction an obstacle to jump-starting the stalled peace process. Palestinians demand a total freeze of settlement construction before renewing such talks. Sahar Kawasma is a Palestinian member of parliament.
The Palestinian Authority position is very clear. No negotiations until settlement construction stops totally, including in East Jerusalem. It is an essential condition. It shows how serious Israel is in resuming negotiations.
Sheikh Jarrah consists of 28 homes that house 570 Palestinian residents. All those homes are slated for demolition by Israel. Settlers groups claim that the land on which Sheikh Jarrah is built used to be owned by Jews before the creation of Israel. Palestinians claim they have owned the land longer, as it was given to them by the Jordanians, who used to control Jerusalem at the time in coordination with the UN. Both settlers and Palestinians say they have documents proving the lands are theirs. Since Israel occupied the city of Jerusalem in 1967, it has continued to construct settlements in and around the city, an act which is illegal under international law. Ghassan Bannoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
Today is World Tuberculosis Day. Health workers across the globe are making new pledges to curb the epidemic, which affects 10 to 13 million people worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. India has the highest rate of infection in the world, and health experts are drawing attention to the connection between smoking tobacco and the disease. From Jaipur, Rajasthan, FSRN's Jasvinder Sehgal reports.
8-year-old Rajni lives in a slum in Jaipur, India. Like her mother, grandmother, and others in her family, she is addicted to tobacco.
I eat chewing tobacco because I like it. I just bought some tobacco for my mother. I give it to my 2-year-old sister too, so that she sleeps easily and doesn't disturb me in my work.
Rajni is one of millions of tobacco users of India, where tobacco-related diseases kill some 800,000 each year. Tobacco is also a leading cause of tuberculosis. Nevin C. Wilson is the director of Southeast Asia Office of International Union against tuberculosis and lung disease.
If you look at the tobacco-related mortality, India currently is estimated to account for close to a tenth of all the deaths in the world.
40% of TB cases in India comes from chewing and smoking tobacco, and with 250 million tobacco users and 700 million kilos of tobacco being produced in the country, India faces a major challenge in controlling and preventing tuberculosis. While India has a program to control TB, it doesn't include tobacco cessation.
The linkages between tuberculosis and tobacco and the linkages between the program are just being explored. We are not far behind other countries. I don't think in any country in the world right now there this linkage between the tuberculosis control program and the tobacco control program are strongly established. And even WHO has only recently come out with recommendations on how these linkages can be established.
According to a study from the Center for Global Health Research in Canada, TB is about 3 times more prevalent among regular smokers than non-smokers. One effort might help reduce those rates. The International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease is launching a trial of a 9-month treatment regimen that has demonstrated strong results in a pilot program. But some say government and health officials could do a better job responding to India's TB crisis. Dr. Srinath Reddy is director of the Public Health Foundation of India.
Well, I think we need greater determination on all fronts to ensure that we are able to provide a comprehensive public health response which is effective at all levels of care to prevent TB in the first place, to diagnose TB through accurate laboratory diagnosis at the primary healthcare level, and for effective treatment, and also to prevent multidrug resistant tuberculosis.
According to a World Health Organization report released Tuesday, 40,000 new cases of multidrug resistant tuberculosis emerge each year, but only 7% are actually being detected and even fewer are being treated. The report also says that 1/3 of the estimated new cases are fatal. Manoj Kumar is a TB patient.
I was infected with TB and was cured in due course of time. As I cannot live without tobacco, I started smoking again. If I get another infection, I'm ready to go for treatment again.
More than 128 years have passed since the microbiologist Robert Koch revealed the bacteria that caused tuberculosis, and today an estimated 2 billion people, roughly 1/3 of the world's population, are chronically infected with tuberculosis. The disease kills about 5,000 people a day, nearly 2 million every year, despite the fact that most cases are completely curable. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSRN, Jaipur, India.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Today's headlines editor was Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at FSRN.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments at FSRN.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.